Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Hi, everyone. Sophia Bush here. Welcome to Work in Progress, where I talk to people who inspire me about how they got to where they are and where they think they're still going. Today's guest is the incomparable Tara Hauska. Tara is a tribal attorney, founder of the GNU Collective, which is an indigenous women-led frontline resistance movement. She is also a co-founder of Not Your Mascots, a nonprofit dedicated to fighting against stereotypical Native representation in sports, or misrepresentation in sports, really. And she is truly just an overall badass, inspiring activist. I'm so happy to have Tara join me to share her story and more about the work that she's doing with the collective on Native land and for Native people. Right now, we're in a time where it seems that more and more of the collective has realized and is beginning to come to terms with how whitewashed our history is and always has been. And we are talking more and more about how Native people have been left out of the conversation. Being left out of the conversation, being left out of history, creates a ripple effect of impact across Native communities that go through this erasure and this whitewashing. The substantial harm that environmental racism does to these communities and the environment at large. Tara and I talk about this erasure and violence. We talk about her work on the environment, and she offers a personal perspective that I think will be enlightening to so many of you at home. She'll walk us through what treaties are, the lack of federal response to violence against Native people, especially Native women, and so much more. And big news, just yesterday, a judge ordered the Dakota Access Pipeline shut down by August 5th. Tara and so many Indigenous activists have been fighting on the front line of this issue, have been chanting and teaching the rest of us, water is life, mini wichoni. This is a huge win for a movement and makes our conversation feel even more timely. Tara will teach all of us how we can lend our support and what justice really looks like. Enjoy. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. I'm such a fan of your work. And I think it's long overdue that we are having these conversations as a society, but I'm also incredibly inspired by the moment that we're in. I saw my dad for Father's Day, and he was telling me that seeing all of you in your generation, it makes me think that all the marching we did for civil rights and against Vietnam and all the times we hit the streets in the 60s and 70s, you know, maybe something's going to change now.
Yeah.
And I was like, Dad, it was kind of interesting. He was saying he felt like nobody was going to listen for a while. And now he's seeing something that he never thought he'd see in his lifetime. So Does it feel different to you now, the moment, the kind of boiling point that we seem to be in?
I mean, it definitely feels different just from like a visibility standpoint of Native people in particular. I think that we've been kind of absent from most of these conversations for a really long time. I think that we still largely are, but it's starting to feel a little different. You know, I mean, I think the resistance that happened in Standing Rock really helped push that forward. But beyond just like our own community and like this specific section of life, I think seeing all the young people, really, like the little 13 and 14 year olds that are talking about like decolonization and patriarchy and capitalism and these really, you know, advanced concepts of like a different societal perspective, like that is really, really powerful to me. You know, like it's like, I was not thinking like that or even comprehending something like that when I was 15 years old, 14 years old. I mean, these guys are, they're really coming up and it's really impressive to see.
It is really incredible. I think a lot about that. I look at, it's funny to be like the youth. I'm like, wait, since when have we not been the right. youth? But here we are. And I look at these young kids and I just think this kind of connectivity, this kind of, you know, smartphones in their hands and the internet at their fingertips, they're so savvy. They've had this language and this ability to connect and to discover information and to discover each other for essentially their whole lives. And it's incredible to see what they're doing with it. Because to your point, I think so many of us that have grown up, you know, relatively conscious or concerned or wanting to defend the environment or whatever it may be, it's historically taken, I think, a lot of us a lot longer to get into spaces where we're really learning about the systems, you know, the things that you're referring to. And these kids, I'm like, you already know about that? How old are you? I'm so amazed by them all. And to see, you know, youth that led that incredible run across parts of the northern part of the country to bring attention, as you said, to protests at Standing Rock, to talk about water rights, to talk about land rights. I'm really in awe of all of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's for our communities, it's kind of, you know, I would say that you are just kind of thrown into it whether you want to be or not. And you know, there's not really, I think, a sense of, am I going to be part of this? But rather, you know, what am I going to do? Like, what fight will I take up, or what mantle, what issue, what am I going to dedicate my time to defend my people with? But one of the differences I really kind of am seeing is just like instead of looking at it like, well, we have to do change from within and that's the way, there's like this whole other, no, like I don't actually want to do that at all. Like, and I will go and talk to those systems and work, you know, with them, but that's not ultimately what we're looking for. We're trying to build something else. And like, that is, I think it feels like a different shift, that learning curve is like much, much shorter. And I think it's also happening too with each generation that like either, maybe they're coming from, you know, civil rights folks who marched in those times, or maybe they're coming from, you know, with our Indigenous people, just from healing, you know, like every generation passed the theft of our people. I mean, my grandmother went through boarding school. That's not an uncommon situation. I mean, many of us, like, they're in their 50s now. Like, everyone's like, oh, that was hundreds of years ago. I'm like, no, that was like literally like living people that were taken out of their home by the federal government. So I think with us, it's like it's that healing that's happening too.
Well, and that's something that I find so interesting. And you brought it up earlier, that in so many conversations that have centered on civil rights and that have centered on human rights atrocities in our history, Native people have been left out of the conversation. And it's been really inspiring to me to see so many of the people that I follow and so many activists on the ground beginning to kind of cross communities and say, hey, if we're talking about our community over here, if we're talking about what happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis, we have to talk about what's happening to Native people in Minnesota. And everyone is like showing up to really, it seems as an observer and a participant in some of those circles, like we're laying bare the truth of all of this whitewashing of our educational system and of our history. And it's one of the things that you highlight in your TED talk when you talk about the fact that when your people have gone through erasure, it then makes it so much easier for people in power or people creating policy, legislation to further erase you in the law because they don't even understand who you are, where you come from, what your history is. And that was like a gut punch for me just to think about it in those terms. You really kind of like cut to the quick of something that I think a lot of people haven't had to think about before. People who aren't part of your community, people who look like me, who, you know, read those history books you talk about that maybe mention the name of one tribe, maybe four, but that's it. You know, there's been a lot that we've not been taught, that we've not looked at, and turning all of this over and understanding, to your point, that the system needs to be rebuilt.
At a minimum, at least be confronted, right, in a real way. And I think that's happening, you know, with all these monuments coming down. Like, that's, and you got like obviously the pushback of, oh, you're just trying to rewrite history and like this is what 1984 is all about. And I'm like, well, if you're really gonna go that angle, I mean, from our perspective, you turned our names of our places and the names of our people into like road signs and like misspelled county names and state names. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there were people that were already here and were already erased. And so, yeah, like, at what point in history do you start saying, well, this is the real history? You know, it's like, no, that's the history that we should all be striving for is one that's honest and accurate, right? Which is, yeah, we learn from it and we don't repeat those mistakes. So we try to do our best to make a better world.
And we have to start thinking about what it means. You know, one of my dear friends and I worked on a TV show in North Carolina for 9 years. And we've challenged the mayor of the city that we lived in for a third of our lives to take these Confederate monuments down. And, you know, the history is that they were put up from 1911 to 1922 by the Daughters of the Confederacy. They were put up as these racist warnings to people of color in the community. They're not part of history. And we were just like, hey, there's real history in America. The Confederacy, you guys, only lasted 4.5 years. So it can't be that you're like that big of a fan of history. Like, you're into the white supremacy. And by the way, where we filmed our show, where these monuments are, they also filmed Dawson's Creek, which lasted longer than the Confederacy. Our show lasted 9 years. That's twice as long as the Confederacy. We were like, are we going to get statues? You know, like, and in a way, there's something about putting that sort of humor into it in our little community made people go, oh yeah, what are we even talking about? You know, we were able to say, like, guys, put them in museums with explanations of history and what we don't want to repeat. We don't need to have these things up. When you have a statue up in public, it is a monument. It is a celebration of something. And we have to think about, to your point, what is it we're celebrating? Like, where are we putting our energy? Who are we literally exalting and putting up on a pedestal? And how, for your community, you know, as a person looking from the outside in, I just think, how could we have erased the history of Native peoples on this land? How could we not acknowledge that almost every city, to your point, cities, roads, counties, I'm like, these, all of these names come from Native language. And so things have always been taken, they've always been reappropriated. And then people try to say that it's not inappropriate to have Native peoples essentially made into cartoons and to be mascots of sports teams. And I'm like, I don't know how we can have that conversation with a straight face.
Yeah, that stuff is, that is, when I moved from my tiny little town in northern Minnesota, more of a village really, and then went to college and met other groups from people that I'd never heard of, you know, growing up very sheltered, and then went to DC and saw that, I was like, I couldn't believe that was a thing, you know, like it was just something that I never really encountered before. And I couldn't believe that people felt it was acceptable to dress up as like another race of people, you know, like that's really basic common sense, right? Like you don't paint your face as another group of people. We know that, like you should not do that. But here's like a whole stadium of people doing that. And also at the same time, having like a clear slur for their name, or doing like the chop or whatever, like these awful chants. And I'm like, wow, like, you know, this is really real. On top of, you know, I ask folks in media all the time, media is incredibly powerful, right? Like it shapes how we think about each other, and it shapes how we think about different groups of people. How many Native newscasters have you ever heard of? Can you name one? How many Native actors can you name? You know what I mean? Like, and people usually aren't flabbergasted by that. Like they're, I don't know. And I'm like, okay, name a Native movie that's not a Western, like literally any, you know? And I mean, it's starting to change a little bit, I think, you know, with some of these like more like streaming platforms or whatever, like Netflix is doing a pretty good job, and Shudder and some of these other ones. But it's, yeah, we just don't, I mean, imagine like having zero representation. And what that does to a people when you're also at the same time holding, you know, still very large swaths of land that has not been completely destroyed and manipulated and extracted from. When you're holding, you know, large mineral deposits or whatever, things that people want now, it's like, well, we put you on that because we didn't want it, but now we want that too. So, you know, but y'all aren't really real people, so we can do this. I don't know. It's not a good scene for sure.
How, because you're referencing parts of your story, you know, even what happened to your grandparents growing up in a small village, and then eventually, as you said, leaving, going to college, having all of this kind of intersectional experience, going to DC, your story is fascinating. And I love to go backwards a little bit with guests to then come forward. You open your TED Talk explaining to the audience that you were born under a maple sapping moon in International Falls, Minnesota. Can you tell us what that means and a little bit about where you were born?
Yeah, sure. I was, so I'm from International Falls, Minnesota. It's a place that some older folks might remember as Frostbite Falls from Rocky and Bullwinkle, where it's always winter. That's my hometown. I was born in the hospital there, but my reserve is actually across the lake. On the other side of the shore, and that's Kuching First Nation. Gojijing means people of the inlet, so it's where this giant body of water drains into a river, and that's where we've been for thousands of years. But it also happens to be not just a border town, but it's an international border town. So there's a U.S.-Canadian border running right through the middle of the lake, which makes me American and a lot of my family Canadian. And the maple sapping moon is, it's actually the maple sapping is the boiling moon. So it's when the trees run with sap and we boil to create maple syrup. So it's a time of the year. Like right now we're in the heartberry moon, it's the strawberry moon. Every month has some significance and tie to what's going on around with the environment and what season we're out and what we're doing at that time.
Mm. And was it always, was it part of your upbringing from the time that you were a child to understand the relationship that your people have to nature? You know, as you say, like every moon has a tie to what's going on in the environment around you. I always think about how so much of Westernized society is missing a relationship or a conversation or communication with the environment. And I'm just fascinated by what it would be like to grow up truly always in communication, always understanding how valuable the environment is to all of us as people.
Yeah. So I actually grew up, my mom is from a tribe as well. She's a descendant of Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe. They're over in North Dakota. But my mom remarried to a Norwegian Finn. So my stepfather is like this very blonde Viking looking guy. Norwegians have been in Minnesota for a very long time. And I would say my upbringing was, you know, not one that was deeply into specifically indigenous culture, but because of our location and where we're at, it was definitely one that was very, very tightly tied to nature. So there's hunting season. That's what feeds us in the winter and into the, you know, from the fall into the winter. Then you have fishing season, you know, the fish are going to sustain you for the summertime. You have when the berries come out, you know, during specific times of summer. I mean, it's a relationship that's always there because you're dependent on it and you are interdependent, right? Like that is literally how you're going to feed your family. And it's something that to me was actually quite shocking to realize that people had almost no relationship at all, that most people don't think about where their food comes from at all. Like they don't even know. Sometimes they don't even know what animal they're eating. Like that was shocking to me. They're like, I think this might be chicken. It could be pork. I'm not really too sure. I'm like, what? Like, how do you not know that? You know? Yeah. And then as I went to college, I, studied, Ojibwe and Anishinaabemowin. That's the language of my people. And started reconnecting back to the reservation and to, or the reserve, I should say, the reserve and to, you know, more traditional teachings and understandings. And it just, to me, has really helped shape all these things that I knew, like the skill kind of around, but now I'm like able to understand like the interconnectedness of all of it and like the teachings that come from like super, super rich understandings of our place. And definitely keeps you very humble as a human being to know where we sit in this big circle. Yeah. But I mean, you still learn those things when you understand, like if you're in the woods and you don't know what you're doing and you are disrespectful to the forest, you could lose your life. I mean, that happens. People die of exposure. People die of getting lost in the woods. So
I'm wondering. Okay, so you talk about going to school and beginning to study language and beginning to then see some of those deeper connections and get into that deeper knowledge. Did that make you look back at anything from childhood differently? Did it then make you kind of want to double down on the work that you do today? I'm curious what that widening purview does, you know, in real time as you are deepening into the experience of your own culture and simultaneously witnessing how precarious things are in that space of law and policy and everything that you then went to DC to work on.
I think for me personally, a deep connection that I formed with the Indian Child Welfare Act and the importance of keeping Native children with their family was specifically because of my own understanding of what it was like to grow up not having that cultural connection and tie and missing that so badly and not really understanding what I was missing. Feeling like the deep kind of like anger and frustration and, you know, lashing out in different ways because of that, like not understanding, like I grew up in a border town. I also experienced a ton of racism growing up. I was, you know, it's 98% white or something like that. So like, you know, it's me and a couple of my cousins and that's the diversity, right? Like that is literally the diversity and like the couple kids that got adopted in by other families. So that was not an easy situation at all. It was just, you know, why are you still here? Well, we read about these people in the history books and they died. So how are you still sitting here? You know, and like me not really knowing how to respond to that and feeling instead very deeply ashamed and like wishing to be like everybody else, you know, and being just so, I guess, dispossessed and disenfranchised from my own self. And so when I found that as a, you know, 19, 20 year old, it was just like, click, like, oh, this is what I was missing. This all makes sense. And it completely shaped and changed the direction of my life because it was going pretty dangerously at that point. I had been through a great deal of trauma and violence at that point, and so it was something that just was like, oh, this is what I was missing, and this is what I was so angry about, and this makes so much sense. Like, this is who I am, you know.
Well, and you reference that in your TED talk as well, that the trauma of Indigenous peoples has been trickling through generations because of centuries of oppression. And as we're having this conversation, you know, we referenced it earlier, having this conversation about what Black people in America have been put through, it's incredibly important that we widen the lens and widen the conversation and also acknowledge what Indigenous peoples have been put through on their own land. I'm curious for listeners who may not know as much about some of those practices, if you can explain a little bit about, you know, what you're referring to. You mentioned that your grandparents had their language and culture stolen. You talked about the boarding schools. I think a lot of people, to your earlier point, don't know how recent this kind of history is. When you're referring to people, to kids being taken from their homes, this isn't hundreds of years ago.
No. That's my grandmother telling me about her father and mother moving their children into a wood pulp camp deep into the forest to try to, one, find work, but also to hide their children, and being tailed by a priest and then having all of their children taken and sent to South Dakota for boarding school, where they were stripped of their language, stripped of their culture, and endured lots and lots of trauma and violence. And what that does to your people, you know, I mean, that's, you're breaking apart a family, right? And you're breaking mm-hmm. apart those connections and those ties. You know, it manifests in all kinds of different ways. Like, there's, you know, some of the saddest stories I can think of that I've heard are folks who came back from boarding school and their parents couldn't speak with them anymore. And, you know, I mean, that the pain they must have felt. I mean, my closest teacher's father, you know, ended up committing suicide because he was so deeply hurt by the fact that he couldn't communicate with his own children anymore. And then that comes through, right? So, like, my grandmother now, who's like in her, you know, she's in her 70s, not knowing anything and being embarrassed about it, you know, and being so happy that somebody has taken that back up, you know, that there are people that are proud of being Indigenous again. I think that means so much. But, you know, I don't think that's that story and that experience is really so far removed from humanity. I think that people are, you know, whenever I talk to quote unquote white people about their own understanding of who they are, you know, there has to be some sort of, I mean, I think it's not real, right? Like, white is, no, you're actually probably like, maybe you're English or you're Scottish or you're Irish or you're all these things. And you probably had this beautiful, you know, or maybe not so beautiful, depending on what the situation was, but at least you had, there was a time that you were deeply connected and tied into a culture that was centered in, you know, the environment around you. And there's a loss there too. You know, maybe it's not so recent as like my living grandmother, but there is definitely a sense of loss. Like there must be, you know, and I think that process of finding who you are and reconnecting to that gives people a deeper fulfillment than many, many other things attempt to.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. It's interesting because what got me into politics in the first place, political activism really, was fighting for the environment. I grew up in Southern California. So for me, the mountains and the ocean and the forests, like those are the places that we spent time. You know, when I was growing up, that's where my parents took me to be out in nature. My dad is from Canada. You know, when you talk about the border towns with the lakes literally in the middle, I'm like, oh God, we've done all the back and forth as a family. And it's funny because you're like literally in the middle of the lake and you're like, I'm in another country now. What's happening? This is so weird.
International waters when you're like in the middle of the like lake, you're like, what?
You realize how silly it is. You're like, what does this even mean? But, you know, my dad grew up, his family you know, when I think about your points about what we've lost generationally, my dad's grandparents had a little farm on the St. Lawrence River. And when Canada installed its major lock system for, you know, those giant shipping boats to come through the river, for people listening at home, essentially it's like these barriers that go up the river and they can fill the locks to raise the water or lower them down. So these big boats can move. But when you fill up a river, it means that you raise the water line. And so my dad's grandparents, like, just it was 1 year the government said, you know, we're taking land back and we're buying land back for essentially nothing. And their farm is underwater. You know, their house is underwater now. And so I think about my dad's stories. I think about my great grandma's, you know, stories of growing tomatoes in Italy. Like, we did, to your point, we all used to have a deeper connection to what was happening around us. And it's not lost on me that we're in this time where people are discussing how to better advocate across so many communities, how to acknowledge history that has been unjustly erased. And you see all these moves around the country of like urban farming. And I, you know, I see all these hipster kids like getting into growing zucchini. And I'm like, something's happening. And it feels really interconnected, the way that you mentioned those relationships can be.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I, when it comes to environmental justice and environmental organizing and all that, I very strongly believe that we do ourselves a disservice by not centering the land first and foremost in all those conversations. We get tied up, or I mean, I don't know, as a whole, I think that we get tied up into following the more understood and familiar paths of, well, we just got to change the elections. And if we change the elections, then we can like make a little bit of change. And we just got to like, you know, maybe we'll just shift some stuff to some solar energy, and then we'll just go to renewables and that'll solve the problem. And then we're trying to like use technology and use the same systems in the same ways that have already been causing massive, massive harm to us, right? And to many, many other living beings. And I think there's so much to be said for a value shift of really deeply understanding land and deeply understanding, you know, our relationship to it, right? Like, instead of being separate and creating these structured kind of human-made separations that are really all in our heads. You know, every single person on this earth needs soil to grow food. Every person needs water to drink and air to breathe. And those are fundamental truths. And it never ceases to shock me that I have to explain that to grown adults who are sitting in positions of quote unquote so-called power, and they've completely forgotten that. You know?
Yeah. You're like, this doesn't just exist by accident.
Right. Or even, I mean, or sitting among fellow environmental colleagues who I think, you know, are overwhelmed. And there is certainly a lot of sadness, I think, of the science of climate crisis and the realities of just how far along we really are in our destructive path as human beings. But I really hope that we don't get too caught up in that sadness and forget why we're doing what we're doing. And we forget to put our feet in the dirt and we forget to remember what it's about, you know, and that's not self-aggrandizement or anything like that. It's about, it's about something else.
Right. Well, how, when you talk about not getting caught and continuing to press forward, I think about the work that you do, and I'm curious, at what point did you decide that you both needed and wanted to do this? I know that obviously I'm like doing all of this research, geeking out on all of the stuff that you're working on. And I know you had internships at the White House and the Department of the Interior, and you know, you've worked in a series of tribal focused lobbying positions. And I'm curious, how did you decide to take that step into this sort of arena of political activism.
I think sometimes there are folks who are, this is what I'm going to do, and I wanted to do it since I was 5 years old, and I'm that person. I am not that person. you know, I actually really wanted to be a doctor, a medical doctor, and work with, you know, pediatrics, and did the whole science thing and all that, and got that training, and ended up learning about the insurance side of medicine in the United States. And I was like totally appalled by that, and went to law school on a whim. One of my partner at the time was like, you could go to law school. And I was like, huh, you know, like I could go to law school. Never had seen Law and Order, like knew nothing about lawyers at all. And just went thinking that, you know, I really like reading and this might be an interesting thing. And kind of, you know, just seeing what was in front of me and working with that and learning from that. So, you know, the place I'm at now, which is I live in the woods about 200 yards up a proposed pipeline route from a, you know, a couple of years ago, I was sitting in a DC office and wearing a suit and doing that every day on Capitol Hill is, you know, at least to me, when I see a truth in front of me, I think the drive that my parents have instilled and the values that we've instilled, which is to be honest with yourself. And I think learning as much as possible about those systems has been super valuable. It's been a learning process, obviously, for myself as a person who's maybe not quite so young anymore, but still not really that old either. But I just saw things that were in front of me and like try to do my best to do the best I could to represent out in the world, in this world.
Can you explain to the listeners what it is you do as a tribal attorney, what that means in kind of in the legal system and what your cases are like and who you find yourself up against?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so when I was a full-time practicing tribal lawyer, I represented tribes all over the country on a variety of issues, everything ranging from doing gaming to Indian child welfare, you know, which is child protection and keeping, trying to keep families together, to, you know, sometimes working on these environmental issues that come across tribal nations' desks. So someone wants to build a pipeline through your res or through your treaty territory, or maybe there's a, you know, nuclear plant that wants to dump waste somewhere in your watershed, or there's just so many different issues that you work on when you're a tribal attorney and you're kind of working at them. At least myself, you can work locally or you can work federally. I was working on a more typically federal level, not so much intertribal governance. And in DC, I was doing a lot of lobbying on behalf of tribes, which means meeting with the delegation of representatives from that particular region and, you know, pushing for things like hospitals, schools, program funding for, you know, everything ranging from youth programs to elderly care, all of that. And it's very strange being a lobbyist in that situation, because then you got us who gets like 5 minutes and you got the guy next to you who works for big oil or big tobacco or, you know, the big ag, and they've got like 2 hours and they're going to go to lunch later. And you're like, oh my God, like this is the state of politics and this is how these politicians are all in. But
well, and so that's something that's really fascinating to me. And for the listeners at home who might be like, wait, what do you mean? The world of lobbying and the inception of what we know to be modern lobbyist culture in America in the 70s has inexplicably damaged our political system and what it's meant to do, i.e. like be for the people, by the people, right? Like, what a joke. That's not what's happening. And if I may, I just want to highlight for you guys at home, part of what Tara's talking about is she can sit and represent tribes and be literally talking about things that that matter in life and death, to your point, water, what's happening, you know, actual nuclear power plants can dump toxic waste. And let's not forget that Donald Trump and his administration just made that even easier. They rolled back water and air protections, which seems insane since, again, to your point, we all have to drink water and breathe air to live, but that's for a separate day. But the fact that these corporate lobbyists, who are the ones essentially defending their quote right to dump toxic waste into watersheds and literally endanger people and the environment, because of how much money they put into the political system, they get so much time. And their systems are essentially called necessary, and they're not, you know. If folks listening to this episode also listened to the conversation that I got to have with Zach Bush last year, we talked about regenerative agriculture, which can completely turn around environmental devastation, also increase profits to farmers by 85 to 90%, cease chemical usage. There's no bad side to this stuff. And yet, because a lot of corporations make a lot of money selling agricultural chemicals and you know, the like back and forth to each other, these systems are allowed to remain when it's us, the people who live here, who are all suffering the side effects. So if this sounds crazy to you, I just want you all at home to know, like, dig in, do some research. Obviously, you know, we'll be linking to Tara's TED Talk and every other brilliant thing she's, you know, spoken at and written for this episode. But I really encourage you to look into this stuff, because so many of us have not only been kind of, so many of us suffer not only the divestment of our relationship to nature, but of our relationship to our judiciary systems and to the people who make these policies. And they kind of get made in the dark, and a lot of us don't know about it. So that's my rant about that. Thank you for the way that you have defended the environment in those rooms. And oh my God, I can't imagine how frustrating it is to get 10 minutes to argue for the environment and for human rights, and then see these polluters get 2 hours. How do you figure out, or how did you, when that was your full-time job, how did you figure out how to not lose it? I feel like I would just be screaming at everybody all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my reaction to seeing a very, even to me, I was pretty shocked at the level of corruption, and at the, once I really understood that, you know, oftentimes congressional members, even with the best intentions, have deep debts that are owed to the party. That they actually have a certain amount of fundraising that they have to do every single day to maintain their position in office, that, you know, we essentially have a system that's unlimited campaign budgets, right? Like, that's what the U.S. system is founded upon, which leads to a whole mess of other problems. Seeing that led to kind of my putting on of another hat, which was I started showing up to protests, you know, and I actually have not been a quote unquote longtime activist. I didn't go to my first march until 2014 in DC. And it was against the Keystone XL pipeline, which I was familiar with because it had been at the White House Council on Environmental Quality when I was an intern there. And so I started seeing this other advocacy stream and seeing the impacts that that had, you know, that specific piece of the project into forcing and bringing to light many issues that I think would not see the light of day had it not been for the people themselves pushing for them and showing up at, you know, showing up at John Kerry's house, showing up at, you know, the, maybe not the White House, the White House has protested every single day, but, you know, understanding like the local governance levels and really pushing all those different levers. And so I basically was a full-time new associate at a big law firm or a mid-sized law firm, and also organizing demonstrations and attending them on my lunch breaks. It was wild.
That's so cool. And I think, to your point, the protests at Standing Rock, the protests over the Keystone XL pipeline were such a wake-up call to so many people about what was happening. And one of the things that made me frustrated about it was learning that the pipeline was supposed to go through like a more affluent white neighborhood, and that everybody protested and said, oh, absolutely not. We're not having that here. It's dangerous. And then the government said, okay, cool. Well, we'll build it through a reserve. We'll build it through territories that belong to Native Americans. And I just can't fathom how that's okay. And yet over and over again, we see that this is how the system here works. Can you walk listeners through this kind of culture of pipelines, how dangerous these things are, and talk to us about what was happening at Standing Rock a bit?
Sure. I mean, I would say that to get a sense of, there are many pipeline maps that exist out there, typically also by right wingers that are saying, look at all these existing pipelines. I can't believe you guys are protesting these ones. There is an aging infrastructure system that is underneath the whole of what's now the United States, or what is to me Turtle Island, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lines of transporting everything from fracked oil to natural gas to tar sands. It's really, really dirty. The dirtiest form of fossil fuels in the world that comes from Alberta, Canada. There is a very heavy push by the fossil fuel industry to continue their method of operation, which is a continual expansion. So no matter what, they have to expand. It's exponential growth. That is what they built their entire model on, which means that as we've reached the point of these old pipelines starting to kind of age and corrode and crack, and they can't hold quite as much, or there's lots of spills and they're blowing up towns and small places all over the country. It happens at least every month. You know, there's some crazy massive explosion that kills a couple people or almost kills some people or whatever, that they want to build new pipelines, really, really big pipelines. Their response is, well, let's leave the old ones. We'll keep the old ones in the ground. We'll let them rot, and then we'll build these brand new ones and keep expanding our industry, and we'll create new jobs with that. You know, that's kind of like their plan, I guess, for however many years until the planet is completely on fire and uninhabitable. You know, and so what was the situation in North Dakota, and why I would say I personally felt so pulled and drawn to go to that place. I mean, I left Washington, D.C. and left, packed my stuff in a rental car and went to this place I'd never heard of, you know? And the reason that I felt so drawn was because, you know, there's so many projects that happen in these out of sight, out of mind places. There's so many of these projects that happen in Indian country specifically. We live in places that are, you know, there's many, many Indians that live in cities in urban populations. About 70% of us actually live in urban populations. But then there's this whole other group of people who are living in reservations, reserves, or in border towns. And we're way the heck out there, you know, where we're out in the land that people don't think of. And we're next to a lot of public land, and we're next to state, you know, forests and national forests and all those things. So when these projects are proposed, they typically get proposed through or near our territory. In Standing Rock, it was proposed to actually go through Bismarck originally. That's the white town that's just above it. They actually didn't really have to protest that much. They literally just were like, no, like, this is dangerous for our people. And they're like, oh, okay. And then moved it south to go through the res. And so it was not, to them, it was risky to put it through this population, but definitely okay to put it through another. And that environmental racism is carried across the board. You know, like, that's Black and brown communities that are in urban centers that are breathing in chemical toxifiers from nearby plants that are magically in their neighborhoods. It's, you know, when I talk to sisters from Emma Lockridge from the dirtiest zip code in the United States in Detroit, it's the fact that her neighborhood, which is a now almost entirely Black neighborhood right next to a tar sands refinery, the same tar sands of the pipeline I'm trying to fight, that the white folks in the neighborhood were offered, here's your home value and you can move somewhere else. But the Black folks in the neighborhood were not offered that same courtesy. You know, it's basically valuing a specific community over another and saying, it's not okay for me, but it's okay for you. And there's not enough of you to really make that big of a difference. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of what we've seen with all these different social justice issues, right? Which is, well, black men are being killed by the police, but I mean, you know, that's you guys, and maybe you shouldn't commit so much crime, right? Or like these ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous responses to it, instead of being like, why are Black people so disproportionately being killed by police? Why are Native people being so disproportionately killed by police? You know, like, what is the issue here? And why is that community being so heavily targeted? Why is that community experiencing such a different treatment at the hands of law enforcement? Yeah, I wish people were more thoughtful in like their, when they're looking at something.
Me too. And I think when you look at the numbers, to your point, the disproportionate killings of Black and brown people at the hands of the police, the disproportionate experiences of everything from poverty to violence that so many Native people experience here in what so many people call America, these things cannot be ignored. What always strikes me as very obvious, in the same way that, you know, talking about the environment felt so obvious, feels so obvious, to you and to so many people in those rooms where decisions are made, it feels so obvious to me that if our neighbors are suffering, so are we. Like, there is no such thing as liberation. There's no such thing as real safety if it isn't for everyone. And my real hope is that is something that is coming into very sharp focus right now for us as people. And when we think about proportions and ratios, something I also would like to offer to listeners, which I find to be so incredibly inspiring and also such an indicator. We often talk about trusting experts, right? Well, we should trust the experts. It's like, well, who are the experts? In terms of what the Indigenous community globally does for the world, Indigenous peoples make up 5% of the world's population, and you are the stewards of 85% of the world's nature and wildlife. We should be, as we design new systems to try to protect the environment, we should be trusting your expertise. And I think about that statistic often when I think about the environment. And I thought about it watching your TED Talk when you talked about how, as you were fighting for the funding you mentioned earlier, that you would be told over and over again, you know, quote, Indian people can't manage their financial affairs. And I was like, excuse me? I'm so amazed by your poise, because you are so... You have this like beautifully even attitude where you just bring up a fact, and I don't know how you do it. I think you're a rock star, because I'm like, my blood is boiling all the time. and I mean, I can't help but compliment you, because I just think you're the coolest person, but I offer some of those interjections into our conversation for the people who I know are listening to this, because I really want to try to put some of this in perspective for the folks who might be listening to whom this is a new conversation. You know, it's important for us to understand the history of everything from Indian culture to treaty rights to what's happening to our environment and the way that so many Native people are really leading the charge to defend it.
We want folks to listen to Greta, and we want folks to listen to the youth strikers and to listen to all of these children that are rising all over the world. Like, that is such a beautiful, powerful thing. Mm-hmm. I really also hope that as people who seem so deeply hung up on statistical analysis and climate crisis being broken down into numbers and figures and, you know, so many articles shared on the latest horrific thing coming out of the Arctic, you know, that it was 100 degrees or whatever, that there's also space and thought for the fact that we're 5% of the global population, we're holding 80% of the world's biodiversity. 5%. So we've got some things figured out, and that we are, yes, we are now kind of like often or sometimes being brought into these spaces with these, you know, typically white male or white female climate faces, as we process information, that we understand that just because the words are maybe not so familiar and because the outlook is not as easily understood, that it's not broken down into a series of statistical data or analysis or whatever, we can give you that too, but that we really try to listen to the knowledge that's being shared. That when we're talking about climate crisis, just from a straight statistical standpoint, you know, if you got a people that's such a small segment of the population holding so much of our future in their hands, maybe we should empower those hands and lift those hands up. You know, maybe like that, it's actually a pretty solid and intelligent and, you know, thoughtful contribution to figure out, how do I empower Indigenous sovereignty around the world? How do I make sure that these extractive industries, these expansive extractive industries, can't continue to do this and destroy the rainforest? That someone like Bolsonaro can't go burn down the Amazon willingly and blatantly in front of the world, burning the world's lungs. You know, that maybe if we had a better network and understanding of how to empower and really try to put in things like rights of nature into our understandings of our legal systems, that our liberation also is tied into that, right? That we can do this together.
From your vantage point, are there suggestions you would make? Because I'm sitting here like fervently nodding. I know there's so many people who are listening to this conversation doing the same. How do you suggest we begin to act on this stuff in real time as people are getting more and more conscientious about calling their representatives and sending in the emails and signing the petitions? What do you think the big pushes can look like for each of us who considers themselves to be, like, you know, just one voter or an average citizen who's trying to figure out how to make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mentioned it in my TED talk, which was, it's hard for me to even fathom what it would look like if treaty obligations were actually upheld, that Indian people did not have to go and fight for services that are mandated by law that we have not had since those laws were signed, that our people were not, you know, I think that it's pretty well understood generally, even in the population, that Indian people are oftentimes in deeply poverty-stricken situations, that, you know, basic healthcare, education, all that infrastructure is woefully inadequate. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you know, we are being put into these, you know, situations because the, you know, the mine is knocking at the back door and we're sitting there with 100 other pressing issues. And, you know, maybe there were 10 suicides in the last month, you know, I mean, of like a very small population. And so it's really hard to be able to be these defenders that we want to be if we're also in a situation where we're dealing so many other things. That I think would help massively. So ask your reps, you know, what are you doing for Native people? What are you doing for Native appropriations specifically? Are you appropriating the amounts to actually fund these programs? But I think on a more deep level, like to anybody that is, you know, listening or trying to figure out, you know, what do I do? I think there's lots of things that we all can do. You know, we can change our carbon footprint individually and we can try to eat conscientiously and buy our clothes conscientiously and think about those hands that are behind it, right? Like think about the hands that are holding each piece of fruit as you pick it up. Think about the hands that are behind each thread that's on your body. You know, I also hope that we are teaching each other and teaching our new generations about other values and about other forms of quote unquote power. Mm-hmm. And I don't think just accepting it wholesale is helpful.
Right. And I'm curious, do you think that there's a real need for deeper education and awareness around what happened and what is happening to Native peoples here?
Absolutely. I mean, education is like, I can't tell you the number of people that I've met that are U.S. citizens that they meet me in D.C. and they would be, I thought you guys didn't exist, like straight up, you know, like just thought we were extinct, or asking these questions that are like, did you ride, like, do you have like a horse? Like, are you, you know, do you live in a teepee or like whatever? And I'm like, yeah, my teepee's got like Wi-Fi in a second story. And they're like, what? And I'm like, what are you asking me? Like, are you serious? Like, but yeah, actually, you know what? It's okay. Like, I actually do have a TV, but that's like, you know, it's living in two different worlds and two different spaces, right? Like, it's not like we just stopped when 1900 hit and like they killed all the buffalo and tried to put Native people onto as many, you know, confined reservations as possible. It didn't end there, you know, it kept going.
Right.
And now there's like a whole bunch of us that are in all kinds of different spaces and places. Some of us are maybe like living the path I'm on, where I'm like half in, half out of, like, you know, I'm half in the forest, half out of the forest, like whenever I'm on the road. But then others are out in DC, they're living in, you know, completely, they're in LA, they're all over the place.
So something that I think is interesting, just from the standpoint of education, again, for folks listening at home, I don't need to tell you this, you're the expert, but for anyone who's listening, who's heard you make reference to the treaty laws that have never been upheld, there's obviously a lot of information available, you know, to you guys, listeners, online, but so that we can understand a little bit about what we're discussing, historically, Congress forced tribes onto land that they essentially assumed was unsuitable for tribes to build self-sustaining economies. And then, Tara, to your point, programs like health services and education services were grossly underfunded. And then the real kicker, guys, comes in when Congress, along with all these kind of big oil lobbyists, realized that the land it had given to many tribes actually had incredible value to natural resources. And that's when Congress essentially attempted to erase Indian country entirely. So this is the kind of fight that exists on the services level, on the environmental level, on the actual geographical level. And when we then begin understanding the complexities of modern experience from protesters being beaten by a militarized police force at Standing Rock to, as we touched on earlier, the experiences of violence that Indigenous people go through, but specifically Indigenous women face the highest rates of violence and sexual assault in this country. It shouldn't be, to your point, statistical, but if we don't look at the writing on the wall and we continue to try to deny that it's happening, we are continuing to add to the erasure of Native people. And I just really want everybody who's listening to sit with that for a moment. And if it upsets you in the way that it upsets me, if it upsets you in the way that I hope that it does, I really hope that we can all follow Tara's lead and figure out how to positively contribute to a conversation, advocate, demand that our representatives are having conversations and demanding resources for these communities, which, again, to your point, those resources are mandated. They've just never been lived up to.
There's that. And, you know, I think our understanding of, you know, even the U.S. gave us something. We gave the U.S. the U.S., you know, like the reality was that they had a very serious Indian problem and did their absolute best to attempt to conquer us. And that didn't work out. And so they had to do it through trying to sign agreements. And then they did their best to try to eradicate us through cultural genocide. That didn't work. Mm-hmm. And so they tried to do their best to eradicate us by taking our children. That didn't work either. And Native people have stubbornly persisted because this is where we're from, right?
Yeah.
And as we exist now side by side with each other, you know, one that, you know, I think there's a level of understanding that any non-Native person can have, which is, you know, whose land am I on? And, you know, how do I come to terms with that? How do I reconcile with that? And what's the best way forward for that? And then two, like to anybody that's, you know, believes strongly in democracy, believes in the, at least the vision of what the United States proposed, which is like, you know, we the people, even though the people were not all the people at that point, right? Like even foundations have some very serious flaws of dehumanization and, you know, human chattel and like all those things. But like, beyond all that, where we're at right now is we're all trying to, at least many of us are pushing for equity and for a real functional democracy. It should upset every single person that's looking at that Native people do not have the same jurisdictional prosecution rates and authority as every other person, every other group on this land. That if a non-Native person comes onto a reservation and rapes a Native woman, that we oftentimes cannot prosecute that person. And if we can, it's at lesser rates. So we can only give them a couple of years and we can only give them a few $1,000 worth of fines. Like that is so shockingly appalling. And sitting in a law school class with your fellow students, as they're sitting here hearing that, next to you and say something like, "That does, wait, this is America. That's not fair." And then you look at them and say, "No, that's your America. This is what we experience here in this country." Mm-hmm. That we actually do not have the same, we don't even have the same laws. You know, we don't have access to the same laws or rights because of a whole series of, you know, Supreme Court cases and also like congressional fixes that have tried to address that for years that have never been able to successfully pass. You know, the violence against women, is, against Native women, is extreme, and it is well known by human traffickers, by drug cartels, by extractive industry, by so many different industries that are extremely harmful to women and children.
Why is the federal response so awful? And it may seem like an ignorant question, but truly, how can it be permissible to allow for those enormous gaps in the law, in prosecution? I understand that it's so many series of events that have been designed to dehumanize the Native population, but what do we do now? How do we, again, how can people listening who might not live anywhere near the communities we're talking about, but who want to lend support, is there anything that can be done about this? Is there a legal battle underway, or is this something that the government is managing to just kind of push under the proverbial rug? What's the current landscape look like?
So they've tried to fix this for ever since the Oliphant case happened, which was the case from the Supreme Court that stripped us of criminal jurisdiction in a very real way, you know, and really left us essentially unable to protect our own people. So that happened in the 50s. And where we're at now is there have been some changes that have happened through legislation. There is a piece of law, the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act, right, that comes up every couple of years or whatever. They've tried to put in fixes within that specifically for Native women and Alaska Native populations. There have been some advances in that. Oftentimes they'll come with caveats of, if you guys are going to be able to prosecute like us, you have to have court systems just like us. So that means you have to have this, and you have to have public defenders, and you have to have jails that can support it, and you have to have this many staff, and you have to have all these things. We're not actually going to fund any of those things, but we're going to make, but you have to have them. Otherwise, you don't get this protection, right? Like, instead of what the situation is, which is if you go into another state, no matter what county it is, no matter how small the courtroom is, no matter how small the jail is, if you commit a crime, you're going to get charged for the crime, right? Like, that's exactly how it works. You know, the pushback that I've seen, and that is not just limited to Republicans, it's also just ignorance across the board, I think, and also apprehension and old fears and a lot of stereotyping, which is, you know, there was this instance, I think, in North Dakota where a statesman got up and said, you know, if this law passes, every white man in America should be terrified to step onto an Indian reservation. And this woman got up in the audience and said, just don't rape anybody and you'll be fine. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's, how could you begin to even say something like that? You know, like that you should be scared to step onto an Indian reservation because you might get prosecuted for a crime you commit. Like, that is, I think, to me, it was an example of really understanding just how deeply entrenched racism is when it comes to Native people, that, you know, we're a population where they'll try to pull racism, that we have to actually prove that so many of us are offended by people literally painting their faces and putting on fake turkey feathers to like show that we're offended. Mm-hmm. You know, that we have national sports teams and Halloween costumes and zero representation in any real way. Like, that is where we're at. And so, you know, I think it's, invisibility has many different outcomes, but some of them are extremely deadly. And that's happening across the board for lots of people. I mean, that's happening with Black men right now, right? Like, that's what happens when your population is systemically undermined, dehumanized, and criminalized. You know, that you are still, quote unquote, savage people.
Well, and I can't begin to fathom what it feels like to live in a country, to live on land, which was always your people's land, but to live in a country that committed a genocide against your people and then refuses to acknowledge that that happened, refuses to accurately include teaching about treaties and Native peoples in its curriculum. And then in present experience, while denying history, purports and upholds racist imagery and this mascot nightmare and denies what's happening to Native women. It feels like, from the outside looking in, it makes me angry and sad. And I honestly am at a loss for words for the totality of the experience. And it doesn't surprise me that there is depression and that there are so many incidents of young people taking their lives in the community. How do you look at all of that and move forward? Because I think anyone who's been through trauma gets asked the question, well, how did you manage? And then you just say, well, I didn't have any other choice. But when you're pursuing, truly pursuing justice for your people, for the environment, how do you then begin to envision something new? Is it through the law? Is it through teaching? Is it through your collective, which we haven't touched on yet? What for you feels like the path forward?
So all those pieces are obviously very painful, right? And it's I guess something that you can become used to, but it never stops really hurting, right? And it never really truly pushes that both anger and sadness away. Like, it's there, right? Mm-hmm. It's there even when you're sitting in circles of other persons of color, or you're sitting with other allies, and people forget that you're there even when you're there, you know, even when you're physically there looking at them, they forget. And then there's also all this lateral violence and hurt within the community, and like, you know, substance abuse and intergenerational poverty and trauma and all of that. And that really hurts also. But, you know, I think this word resilient gets thrown around a lot when Native people are brought into the conversation, the times that we are, that we've been through genocide after genocide after genocide and are still here. And to me, I think, you know, the strength of the wisdom that has passed between Indigenous generations of people is so incredibly powerful. And like, to me, it's grounding, right? It's like, I know that I'm standing on my own 2 feet, and I know that I'm holding this wisdom that's been passed on through generations, through thousands of years, that I fully grasp that I'm standing in like this very long line of people who came before me for me to be here. And that I am hopefully going to have this very long line of people that come after me. To me, it's that, you know, and that's maybe specific to maybe Indigenous wisdom and those ceremonies and those teachings and the language and all the pieces that are, have kept our people around for all these years. But I think there's also something to be said for really truly understanding that you are just one link in this big chain. And rather than feeling overwhelmed by that, feeling deeply comforted by that, that you have so many people who stood behind you to get you here, you know, that your life is so important and that you have this one chance to be in this plane of existence, that we have this one opportunity to do something and say something or contribute something. Maybe it's art, maybe it's music, maybe it's advocacy, maybe it's, you know, something, maybe it's just maybe here to make a family and make the best children in the world you possibly can. You know, like, there's so many beautiful pieces, and to me, there's so many beautiful pieces of being an Indigenous person. You know, it just comes with it. You know, there's the ugly, hard pieces too, but the beautiful parts are so powerful.
That's beautiful. What, when you're rooted in that, because that feels like it's so swollen with potential and goodness, and it's that kind of perspective that, just for me as a human and as a person who's on the outside looking in on this particular experience, it makes me feel like, hell yeah, there's a path. What does justice look like in your mind? What do you hope to cultivate and to see moving forward?
you know, the space that I and other folks have worked really hard to create, which does touch on the work that our collective does, is we've built this, you know, this resistance camp, right, that does a lot of direct action and advocacy, and we go after fossil fuel funding and, you know, in corporate spaces and in the streets and all these different things. But it's also a space that is very deeply grounded in Indigenous traditions and wisdom, which includes food sovereignty, which includes, you know, this healing that's so needed. And that means things like chopping wood for elders and showing up at medicine lodges and putting in work and helping, you know, the Sundance Lodge come together, helping the elder get connected to the youth that needs to, you know, that needs that. And for me, that means doing my absolute best to use the understandings that I've learned in the westernized world to uplift and, I guess, empower the teachings and the strength that's within the Indigenous world, and to always carry all the Indigenous world with me no matter where I go. You know, I think I think that English does it's a language that does a disservice, right? Like we're speaking in English right now, and it's so limiting. You know, for me, like I think of the word, one of the lodges I'm part of and teachings I've been learning for a very long time, ever since I was 20, which has been a while now. Madewin is, you know, the basic English translation, just like medicine society, right? It's just a medicine society. But Madewin is about, Ode is like your heart. And so the word, it's an, you know, words are really action filled. It's really about someone filling someone else's heart. So I'm filling the knowledge of my heart and filling yours, you know? And so thinking of it like that, you know, thinking about filling your heart up and keeping it full and maintaining that and filling that with love and from teachings from others, like that is, you know, I think that having that would help so many people overcome all these doubts and struggles that they carry with them in so many spaces. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see a lot of really hurt people operating in a lot of different spaces. That sucks.
To me, it almost feels like a reclamation is necessary, like a reclamation of our humanity, our intuition, our relationships to nature. I think about, I remember as a kid, my dad actually teaching me, he talked to me a lot about, you know, what I wasn't learning in the history books. And he wanted me to read books about Native people. And I'm so grateful. It's crazy as an adult. I look back, I'm like, God, my parents are pretty fucking cool. Like, they're just some cool dialed humans. And my dad, seeing how geeked I was on nature, I remember as a kid, asked me to consider a Native principle that you would make decisions based on how they would affect 7 generations into the future. And I think about how profound that is, how beautiful that is. And I also think about the profound loss that's happened in so many cultures that don't think that way. The damage we've caused to the world around us and to each other. And of course, there's a lot of hurt people walking around. We haven't really considered our impact and the impact we have on each other. And so when I think about the work that your collective is doing, when I think about all these youth activists demanding change, I'm like, there it is. There are spaces where we are demanding to consider our impact in real ways and in deeper ways. And I feel really incredibly inspired about building new systems with those considerations. So I guess that's my very long-winded way of saying thank you for the work that you're doing and for taking the time to, you know, come and have a conversation. I must admit, I'm usually I feel like I'm usually better at this, but I'm genuinely just such a fan of yours and trying to figure out how to do the thing as host where I'm like, what if someone who's listening to this episode doesn't know anything about this? I have to ask questions that feel obvious, but also are not obvious. And I'm trying my best to also just keep my shit together. So thank you for your humoring me for the last hour and a half. I have one more question for you, and it is my favorite thing to ask everyone who comes on the podcast, because it's always a place that I tend to find some new thought. The show is called Work in Progress, and I'm curious, what is the idea of a work in progress stir for you right now? What feels like a work in progress, either in your life or in the space around you that you're thinking about at present?
I'm a work in progress. I think every single person walking this earth, as the way I've been taught, is that we are all a work in progress. When we sit in a circle together in a lodge, there are elders that know a lot, right? And then there's little babies at the end. And then there's people like that are maybe somewhere in the middle, and they're trying to learn the most they can so they can pass it on to the next babies that are coming in, right? Like, and that's how the lodge is oriented. But every single person sitting in there is all a work in progress, because we're all pitiful human beings, and we are doing our absolute best to do the best we can in this life that we have, and that we're going to make mistakes and we're going to screw up and we're not going to be the best people we could be in that moment, but we can always pick ourselves back up and try again. Yeah, I'm a work in progress. So I'll definitely say that. I'm always trying to learn as many new skills and learn as many new bits of wisdom as I really can to do my best and to be a beneficial piece of my community and of this time I have here. Protecting those Zoomers, right? Those little Zoomers that are coming up. I just learned what they were called the other day, and I was like, oh, is that what you guys are called?
I love that.
When did millennials turn like 35? Like, when did that happen?
Honestly, I don't know. I realize I'm a millennial, and I'm like, oh yeah, we're not the youth anymore.
Yep. That was a crazy thing. But I really appreciate the time. And
oh my gosh.
That you asked.
Likewise.
It's super cool. I told some of the Zoomers that I was going on a podcast with you. They were like so excited.
Oh, I love that. That's so cool. Well, I'm just so amazed by the work that you do. And if there's ever any ways that, you know, we can lend any kind of support, I'm in. I was lucky enough, you know, everyone's been talking about like what's happening now. And I don't know if people are sending me like astrological memes being like, the last time this was in this and this was in that. And that, it's like all these three social movements and now it's all happening at once. And I keep thinking back after the first, I want to say it was like maybe the first 8 months of Standing Rock really like being on the news and everyone knowing what was going on. One of my buddies was on the ground there for almost a year, and he was bringing one of the elders there and his son to California to help do some political action. And I was living in Chicago at the time, and they came and stayed with me for, it was supposed to be 2 days, the three of them, my buddy Sean and Frank Iron Eagle and Frank's son, who's amazing. And they wound up staying with me for a week. And every night we'd like sit, we'd have a bourbon and we'd just like talk about life. And Frank was telling, he told me something I've not forgotten. And I think about it a lot. He said that we were leaving the last leg of the buffalo and entering into the body of the elk, and that the elk is the sacred feminine, and that we were going to come back to this divine female energy and that it would be a whole new world order. And he looked at me and he was like, we're ready for the women to lead. And I was like, when does this happen and how can we help it? I keep thinking about that. Even last week, again, statistics shouldn't be the point, but they help me win arguments with Republicans sometimes.
Oh, for sure. They also help even with each other, right? Like people, we've just been trained to think.
Yeah. The math is helpful. And I was looking at the stats on COVID and how every country that's run by a woman has essentially beaten coronavirus. And I was like, bring me that elk, Frank, like, bring it on, you know? So I know it's so tumultuous and wild, but I really hope that what we're seeing does it. I hope there's a whole new world order coming.
I think there is. I mean, I think it's going to be women, transgender, two-spirit, BIPOC, all the things, like the multi-generational and beautiful and cultural rainbow of people that are out caring for each other is so powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, in Minneapolis, in the streets, like, it was so many youth just leading and caring for each other so beautifully. That made me so happy. And being kind of like that old leftover, like, really patriarchal, like, this is how we do things, and we're going to go yell at a microphone and blah, blah, blah. And, like, all these youth are like, hell no, we're not doing that. Where is the women? Like, where are the women? And, like, where are the two spirits? And where, I was just like, hell yeah, guys. Like, we got this. You know what I mean? But you guys have had your turn, and look what you did.
Look what you did. Yeah. I'm inspired.
I appreciate you sharing the space.
This show is executive produced by me, Sophia Bush, and Sim Sarna. Our supervising producer is Allison Bresnick. Our associate producer is Caitlin Lee. This episode was edited by Matt Sasaki. And our music was written by Jack Garrett and produced by Mark Foster. This show is brought to you by Clap Brilliant Anatomy.